Before I came here tonight, I thought, now what are we going to do with that extra 10 minutes we left for Martin Marty? He called this morning, said he couldn't get a flight out of Chicago because the airport was closed down. But it seems that Martin Marty has something going for him because he's standing right over there. We have another speaker scheduled for his slot, but let's put him in now. Dr. Martin Marty.
Gentlepersons, the cab driver just told Dick McAuliffe, our lay friend from Chicago, and me, that when people are in a hurry, they talk extra fast. And he could tell we were in a hurry. We've been trying since 2 this afternoon to get here. And in my deep pessimism this morning, I even recorded my words, which are in somebody's recorder here. And I had one of those eerie feelings that I might come in and hear me. I don't yet feel put together. Don't know if my hair is done up right or whatever. I begin with a word of explanation and apology. This week, my column in the Christian Century gives the birth date of the seminary as being 1939 instead of 1839, and many people have been writing letters. One of them said, "The effect must be as distressing to you as it is distracting to us." More or less, the letter went on, as if you presided at a solemn occasion with your fly open. We're rectifying it this week. An editor said, "How wonderful that with a stroke of a pen we can add 100 years backward in the life of that seminary. Wouldn't it be wonderful if just as easily we could add 100 to its future?" We who believe in the resurrection don't yet know the shape of that future, but we have all kinds of hopes. It's an honor to be invited back as an alumnus to greet the members of Operation Outreach and this obviously supportive community. I've spoken to the Concordia community 4 or 5 times in these 22 years, but never with a heart as full as tonight. This place is Concordia tonight. I speak also out of the community of higher theological education, represented here by sister schools as well, to extend from my corner of it a sense of our regard and awe to the students, the faculty, the various staffs here, their spouses, who at what has suddenly become the best-known seminary in the country, are also pointing out some directions in which people in our field who care about excellence and integrity and freedom in the gospel of Jesus Christ are watching. My brother and I had been commissioned to write the history of the Missouri Synod for its 125th anniversary, a commission we think we resigned from in the summer of 1969, foreseeing the disruption of 122 years of continuity in the synodical family. For we could foresee that there were trends that suggested that instead of remaining a family which settled its conflicts familially, we would soon be warring political factions or parties at war. From persuasion, we were moving to coercion. From conversation to compulsion. From being a confessional church which says, "This we believe," to being a legalistic body that says, "This you must believe or we will eliminate you." We had been theonomous, somehow transparent to the divine word, and were becoming heteronomous, responsive to other and human forms of laws. I threw in theonomy and heteronomy as a badge of identification and a symbol of the fact that I am a part of a theological community, and why invest in a plane ticket if I don't use a little jargon? What if, by God's grace, the old continuity could be taken up again, and we were to return to write of the current chapter? What would we say in the journalists or historians' who, what, where, when, why, how spirit? Very briefly, who? We would tell them that old Dr. Walther knew what he was doing when he bannered 1 Peter 2, 9, and 10 for the ancestral band of Saxon exiles. For people today are keeping an outreach going as a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a dedicated nation, and a people claimed by God for his own, to proclaim the triumphs of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You are seeking simply what they sought, a place where you can enjoy, let me quote, without interference, the complete and unadulterated means of grace ordained by God for all men unto salvation. End of quote. In these 2 weeks, we've seen an impartation of a grace to people who stand in this tradition. I'll never forget the words Roy Larson in Chicago used last summer respecting Dr. John Tejan. In case any of you missed it, quote, a distinctive product of his tradition, he is characterized by a rare combination of discipline and grace. His discipline has not made him harsh. His gracefulness has not left him weak. Now let me say, he is not alone. What is the second question? We would tell our future readers that this outreach found you talking and listening to an eager but frightened, loving and hating, trusting and suspicious church body that needs the story. You have been translating it to today's words and actions and risks, the story of how God called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Darkness comes in many forms and beckons again. It can seduce and delude and look comfortable. But you are called to his marvelous light. No one compelled, urged, or made easy this outreach of faculty, student body, staff, pastors, lay people, children. But you've learned of the gift of these resources and of this tradition and this marvelous light. And you will not let this darkness fall upon you. Where? We would tell them in such a chapter that your outreach has gone all over the nation and been supported not only by many in your church and the other Lutheran groups, but so visibly and palpably by people of other Christian communions. You have never been closer to them, and they to you, in sharing this marvelous light, which is not only a light for the churches. Outreach is confined if we do not carry it into all the world. And maybe we are learning how these days. When? In a future history, we would tell them that was begun in January 1974, continued in unforeseeable forms. Those who meet a test need never again fear. Witness the Christian heroes of resistance in different circumstances against the 20th century totalitarianisms. Bishop Orjas of the Church of Hungary, Bishop Lilia, Kaj Munk of the Church of Denmark, and others who said never again would fear of men hold them back. As time passes, many of us will make many kinds of decisions. None of us should judge others. We cannot know their inner life and their inner terms. But years later, we know that if someone compromises on terms which he or she knows are inappropriate for themselves, we could know the toll it takes within them. George Bernanos, little priest who said, God, I breathe, I inhale the night. The night is entering into me by some inconceivable, unimaginable gap in my soul. I myself am the night. But you are called to the marvelous light. Second last, why? We would tell them in such a book, oh, that it be written one day, how this operation of outreach occurred. Why? Because people had no choice. When God's marvelous light reaches people who are important to us, and then it comes to us, if we have seen freedom and courage, we cannot help but extend the story. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, perhaps our greatest writer today, a model of witness and ministry, tells us that he is telling the story out of respect to other people's sacrifices and is thus at peace with himself, though he will probably pay a higher price than any of us even dream. And he wrote to the church in Russia, "Let us not deceive ourselves that external chains have power over our souls. Things were no easier at the birth of the Christian faith. Nevertheless, it held out and prospered, and it showed us the way, sacrifice, and finally how." Each year, I reflect on one Hasidic story. Here is this year's. A rabbi whose grandfather had been a pupil of the founder of the movement, the Baal Shem Tov, was once asked to tell a story. "A story ought to be told," he said, "so that it is itself a help." And his story was this. My grandfather was paralyzed. Once he was asked to tell a story about his teacher, and he told how the great Baal Shem Tov used to jump and dance when he was praying. My grandfather stood up while he was telling the story, and the story carried him away so much that he had to jump and dance to show how the master had done it. From that moment, he was healed. This is how stories should be told. Martin Buber comments, "Story is itself an event. It has the quality of a sacred action. Outreach has been basically storytelling, but it has not just been about God's marvelous light. It has been a celebration of it and a bringing of it, an enjoyment of it. So if we are ever to write that book, we do not know what will become of Concordia and Missouri, but we know that all of you who would remain servants of the church will find a way, or a way will be found." I'm going to close with a quotation by William Stringfellow, but also let you know that I will leave this lectern tonight with a great deal of curiosity, wondering whose place I took, because I thought I was being introduced, and all I was being greeted, so I can enjoy the rest of the evening, and I shall do so. Keep this outreach going. Stringfellow says, "In the face of death, live humanly. In the middle of chaos, celebrate the word. Amidst Babel, speak the truth." In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, peace.
Let's keep standing up while we sing.
The song "Reaching Out to Men" is to the tune of "Blowing in the Wind." It also refers to reaching out to women and little children and all of God's people.
Thank you.
These words are addressed to Dr. Marty. The man who consented to take your place is now going to speak. I have that written down too. That's the fun about rallies is that you never quite know what you're going to do next. So you have to keep your little notepad. Our speaker is Dr. Robert Jewett, a professor of New Testament at Morningside College. Dr. Jewett came to our attention through Professor Bertram and Professor Schrader, and I believe Professor Weierman as well, who met him at a conference a few weeks ago. He is actually a Pauline scholar, his first book on Paul being written in 1971. Since then, he has written a book on zeal. And tonight, he's going to address us briefly on Romans chapter 12 under the title, Faith and the Problem of Zeal. Dr. Robert Jewett.
My friends, little did I know when I got a call in Sioux City in the early afternoon that I should come down to St. Louis, that the man I was to replace would be here. When I saw him, I had a great sigh of relief and thought, that gets me off the hook, but here we are. As I was coming into the cathedral, one of your ministers gave me an excerpt from a little booklet called Portals of Prayer, which is published by a subversive organization called Concordia Publishing House. And he informed me that on the day the moratorium began, the meditation was on the theme of the traveling man. And that traveling man was none other than Paul of Tarsus, on whom I'd like to speak tonight. And in this meditation, the motif of human opposition to the power of God is lifted up. How by nature we are opposed to God, even if we do not persecute his followers. And it has the line, the church would do well to return to Paul's example. Well, my friends, I come before you tonight as one indebted to that Pauline heritage, as a student of the Pauline doctrines of grace and freedom. I also come to you tonight as a child of the Reformation, convinced through my own Wesleyan heritage of the depth and propriety of those great themes of Martin Luther, justification by grace alone, the dangers of works righteousness, the priesthood of all believers, the doctrine of sola scriptura, the conviction that the grace of Jesus Christ is the canon of Scripture, the standard by which Scripture is to be interpreted and understood and preached, the gospel. And finally, I speak to you tonight as one who has reflected and thought over these past few years on the problem of fanatical zeal, the kind of crusading spirit manifest in so much of the history of Western Christendom, witnessed in so unfortunate a way in our own history, with our persecution of minorities and our tendency to understand wars as great crusades against demonic foes. And from the Pauline heritage out of which I speak comes my conviction tonight that the struggle you are grappling with here is really an expression of that Reformation spirit. It's an expression of the Pauline spirit as I understand it. It is true to the meaning of the gospel. Your cause, I think, is the cause of that traveling man, if the message of his letter to the Romans is to be taken into account. And so I'd like to base my reflections tonight on Romans 12 and 10, where Paul deals with the problem of zeal. The dilemma which comes to light there is basic, it seems to me, to the problem you face here tonight. On the one hand, Paul speaks with biting sarcasm of zeal, in chapter 10, where he speaks of his Jewish opponents I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but it is not enlightened. And then on the other hand, we hear him speak in chapter 12 in quite a different vein. Never flag in zeal. Be aglow with the Spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in your hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. Now the surprise here in Paul's recommending zeal relates to the fact that Paul himself had suffered so long and so bitterly at the hands of religious zealots. In town after town, he had fled from the zealous rabble-rousers, Gentile and Jewish alike. In the very year, the very winter in which he's dispatching this letter to the Romans, he would be delayed in his intended departure toward Jerusalem by that shipboard assassination attempt by zealous nationalists. Why would Paul, a victim of zeal, come to speak so positively in one breath and yet so negatively in the other? Well, it seems to me that underneath that seeming contradiction lies an insight which is basic to your dilemma here tonight. It is that a sickness can overtake zeal. A sickness can come upon the religious law, turning it into an agency of human destruction. And the name of that sickness is self-righteousness. And the cure of that sickness for Paul of Tarsus is the love of God, which shatters human pretensions and restores man to his humanity. I'd like to speak about that sickness of zeal. Paul describes it there in Romans 10. I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but that it is not enlightened. And he uses the traditional term for zeal there in the Greek zelos, a term which he avoids in the discussion of zeal in Romans 12. His Jewish fanatic enemies, he admitted, did have a zeal for God, but it was not an enlightened zeal. Paul should know, for he himself had had that kind of zeal in the depths of his being, leading him into that persecution of heretics before his conversion. And he explains that zeal in the following sentences as follows. For being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God, and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. The issue here, it seems to me, is a perennial one. In the case of the fanatics who had been persecuting and harassing Paul at every step, it was a matter of holding so firmly to their own self-righteousness under the law that they had to persecute anyone who did not conform. Salvation by law always leads in the end to heretic hunting. That is precisely what led to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Hence, as Paul goes on in Romans 10, Christ is the end of the law, for everyone who has faith may be justified. And it seems to me the same issue was being fought through by the reformers themselves, if one would take the trouble to read them. And one of the odd things about the current dilemma is that some defenders of orthodoxy seem to have so little grip on the Lutheran message. Luther, it seems to me, grasped Paul's message with unparalleled clarity, that works righteousness leads to violent opposition against God, while justification by faith alone leads to meekness, to love, to tolerance. And his words on that issue in the 1531 lectures on Romans have an amazing relevance, it seems to me, to what you face tonight. He identified the Catholic fanatics of his own day with the zealots of Paul's time, placing the issue of fanatical zeal on the side of legalism, while placing faith on the side of grace alone. And I quote him as follows from that great commentary. The doctrine of the fanatics today is the same as that of the false apostles at that time. If you want to live to God, they say, that is, to be alive in the sight of God, then live to the law, or according to the law. But we say in opposition, if you want to live to God, you must completely die to the law. Human reason and wisdom do not understand this doctrine, Luther went on. Therefore, they always teach the opposite. It seems to me that these motifs of human reason and wisdom, which Luther lifts up, have a great deal of relevance for us as we think through our dilemma tonight. Because fanatical zeal always tends to confuse mere human wisdom with divine truth. And as you look back on our history, I think you would agree that you have to really absolutize your own principles, your own human wisdom, to be enthusiastic about bloody purges like those. And if the purges against our American Indian brothers required that we raise the mores of our white race to the absolute, then it can similarly be said, it seems to me, that the present struggle in the Church of Martin Luther is whether the moral and theological legacy of the 1840s in Germany and of the 1920s in America shall be the new law, the new wisdom by which the gospel itself is to be measured. Shall a partial vision of the truth, a limited perspective bound to a certain culture at a certain time, abrogate the teaching of Jesus and Paul? That's the sort of question Luther raised in his own day. And may I dare to repeat his courageous line, which thrusts itself steadfastly against all the wisdom of the Middle Ages and all the rage of the fanatics then and now. But we say in opposition, if you want to live to God, you must completely die to the law. The issue you face here, it seems to me, is basic. Basic to the church. Basic to our civilization. For we cannot maintain an open society, a democratic society, which is so under attack these days, if we give way to the fanatical, legalistic spirit. For that spirit counters the spirit of tolerance, and it even destroys the capacity for love. Grace, my friends, is the essential premise of a democratic society, of a healthy church, for it accepts each person as an equal in God's sight. It refrains from arrogant persecution of opposing viewpoints. It derives from its humble grasp of the truth a due sense of mercy, a due sense of toleration. Legalism, on the other hand, produces the aggressive spirit. It encourages violence against those of different color, of sex difference, those of different class, of different race, of different nationality. It breeds the kind of violence which has so long corroded our own society in America that it threatens now to tear us apart. The issue you face is the issue our culture faces, it seems to me. And it will take a commitment to the gospel to break the demonic forces which seem to be pitted against the open society. But if fanatical zeal is so destructive, so tied to justification by works, how is one to behave when confronted by it? That's the question Paul takes up in Romans 12. He works out in Romans 12 the distinction, the fundamental difference between firmness of faith and the fanaticism of zeal. It seems to me that that distinction is basic to the gospel. You see that distinction in the terminology Paul chooses in Romans 12. And all through his letters, he always uses the typical term zelos, or zeal, in a negative sense. Whereas in Romans 12, in the passage that I read to you, never flag in zeal, be aglow with the Spirit, serve the Lord. He uses the other term for zeal, spude, which was defined by that great conservative Lutheran scholar in Tübingen as clarifying consuming decisiveness of faith far from human enthusiasm. And he notes that Paul uses that term in Romans 12 as the decisive mark of the Spirit. And as you hear Paul's line, you see the connection. Never flag in decisiveness or zeal. Be aglow with the Spirit. Serve the Lord. And at each point, The vast difference between fanatical zeal and the decisiveness of faith manifests itself. Because faith is decisive, and yet, if the biblical sense of faith is retained, faith is always open, subject to doubt, to growth, subject to divine intervention. But the zeal of religious fanaticism is absolute, closed, antithetical to faith. It is an absolutizing, really, of the moral convictions of the self. Fanatical zeal is in the end idolatrous, neglectful of the first and second commandments, and hence destructive to life. And as the psalmist confesses it, "My zeal consumes me." Any person who absolutizes his own rage is consumed and consumes the society he touches. But Paul says, never flag in decisiveness. And goes on to say, be aglow with the Spirit. Paul's kind of decisiveness of faith derives from the Spirit, while fanatical zeal closes itself off from the Spirit. The Spirit of Christ brings freedom. It sets man free from the law, free from his former compulsions, free in the end from himself. Fanatical zeal, on the other hand, locks one in to the limited vision of the self. It closes the self off defensively against the world, and in the end, it closes God out also. And so Jesus discovered with the Pharisees that that kind of fanatical zeal ends up sinning against the Holy Spirit. It is so sure of its own righteousness that it will put the Christ to death. And that ties in with the experience of Paul. And the same precedent can be traced all the way down through history to those heretic hunters who once again hunt down men of faith, harass them out of the church, and try to impose upon them a partial vision of the truth as absolute. And just as Paul discovered that the persecution of the church which he was carrying on was kicking against the goad, so men have discovered through the ages that that kind of zeal opposes the Spirit of the living God, who never can be confined to our theological formulations. But the third part of that sentence, never flag in decisiveness, be aglow with the Spirit, serve the Lord. And by serve the Lord, Paul clearly meant serve the living Christ. And here again, there's a vast difference between the fanatical zeal and the decisiveness of faith. Fanatical zeal serves ultimately the self because it presumes to have in its possession a final, absolute version of the truth. It raises human virtue to the ultimate. It idolizes a partial vision. And it comes always to serve cultural idols and self-made images, which are far different from the living Christ. Decisive faith, on the other hand, knows itself only in obedience. It recognizes that it never has better than a partial vision, that it always must see through the glass darkly, and hence it submits to the truth wherever it occurs. It knows itself bound to the love of Christ. Or as Paul put it, the love of Christ constrains me. And from that starting point, from that line, never flag in decisiveness, be aglow with the Spirit, serve the Lord, the whole of the Pauline ethic follows logically. And he goes on in those magnificent words to urge them to rejoice in your hope, be patient in tribulation, be constant in prayer. And it seems to me that those words ought to be our closing here tonight. For our tendency is to rejoice only when we find certain victory, when we're sure that it will come out all right. But when we grow uncertain, we lose our joy. To rejoice in hope is a recipe for living in the midst of darkness. One hopes in the triumph of divine love. And even though persecuted and harassed, one does not give up joy, the kind of joy you exhibit in your singing this night. To give way to despair, to count the odds too closely, is to give up that life-giving joy which is so essential to survival. And it's to wish for some life other than the life under the sign of the cross. So how does one face tribulation? Paul goes on to say, with patience. Now, patience is a far cry from resignation. Paul started on that theme of the decisiveness of faith to counter any kind of quietistic spirit. The patience of faith plugs away coolly, steadily, without petulance. It is dogged, while zeal, on the other hand, is rigid, crystalline, subject to sudden collapse when the tide of battle inexplicably turns. And finally, Paul exhorts his hearers to be constant in prayer. This implies depending on God's power rather than our own. It implies praying for the redemption of our enemies. It implies asking for forgiveness and restoration day by day, yea, in a time of crisis such as you are undergoing, hour by hour. Constancy in prayer counters that tendency to hope only in one's own power. It counters that tendency to so absolutize our own position that we become fanatics like those who oppose us, and we become as closed to the Spirit as others can be. Constancy in prayer, that is what assuages the overzealous spirit. That is what gives comfort to the weak-hearted, power even to the peacemakers. And I'd like to conclude on this note. Paul never confuses the humble yet decisive quality of faith with a willingness to compromise the message of the gospel. He will not throw the heretics out. He keeps opponents within the church, preferring to keep the vital dialogue alive between men of faith. But in Galatians and Romans, we see Paul's adamant refusal to submit to a zealous spirit which would turn the gospel of grace into bondage to law. He refuses that spirit which would lynch its opponents in underhanded, closed-door decisions. And when faced by an alternative like that, Paul, the traveling man, would say to you tonight, I think, keep the outreach going, even in the midst of darkness. Amen.
We'd like to, at this time, recognize a few more groups of people. Would all of the students who went out stand up? And the students who stayed here, stand up. And as behind every good professor, there's a good Mrs. Professor, behind every good student, there's a good Mrs. Student. Stand up. There's an awful lot of people on this list. There are a lot of people to be thanked for taking decisive steps, for standing up for what they believe. We thank the staff and secretaries of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at 500 North Broadway. Would they stand? We thank the mission staff and missionaries. We also thank the seminary secretaries who took a stand. There are countless others. I'll list them and we'll applaud at the end because we're running short on time. The people who, for the ones who stayed here, managed to keep body and soul together, the kitchen staff. The district presidents, who, by the way, are meeting on Thursday and Friday of this week. And we request that you would remember them in your prayers. All of the St. Louis pastors who have been so supportive. All of the parochial school teachers from this area. Elam, Evangelical Lutherans in Mission, who have done a great job for us. And I've also been asked to say that a representative from the black community of St. Louis is here to say a few words to us. Jim?
Thank you. I, too, am a fellow seminarian, and I, too, agree with my brothers. And I have a message from the church, particularly from one facet of it, and that is its black community. So I bring you greetings, oppressed brothers and sisters in the Church of Jesus Christ, and welcome you to that church which is also oppressed. We welcome you to the struggle that we as oppressed people, not only black, but whites and other minorities, have been fighting for so long. I too was a person who was on Operation Outreach, and I had the distinct pleasure of going out to the East Coast, particularly to the city of Brotherly Love, although some people might wonder after hearing President Sharman's comments whether the city is still a city of brotherly love. But as I minister to my fellow Christians, I had the distinct pleasure of ministering to my family also, and to what I believe as a Christian, and particularly as a black Christian. And as I met my grandfather, who will be 84 this February 8th, and still working, by the way, he just had one question to ask me, which he always asked me, whether we're in good times or bad. And that question was, do they know you're there? And I answer him, yes, with the power of the Holy Spirit, they know I'm there. Therefore, as a representative of the black community, I too want to let you know that we are there. We want to be involved in your struggle because it is also our struggle. As I talk to many blacks, particularly on the East Coast, and by telephone to other places, there's a great concern among the community, both here in St. Louis through the consortium and through every crack and corner of these United States and the world, that among Lutherans and Christians, they want you to know that they are there. Therefore, I would like to read part of a resolution which will be read later to you, but I think it's significant as a member of the black community. We, therefore, the black community, pledge ourselves to Jesus Christ in the spirit of liberation, as amplified in our black fathers and mothers, as other oppressed people, to continue to fight the good fight of faith in Jesus Christ. Thank you.
Finally, we'd like to recognize the committee that planned the rally. Will all of those people stand? We'd like to recognize the entire moratorium coordinating committee. Will those guys stand? Now it has come to my attention that the faculty has a statement to read to us tonight, and so I call on the faculty's representative, Dr. Robert Bertram. Dr. Bertram.
Bob Rimbo has called on one after another of you to stand up and be recognized. He scooped me just a moment ago when he asked the students and the students' wives to rise. I won't ask you to do it again, but it is to that upstanding group that I especially would like to address my remarks right now. I do speak in behalf of the faculty majority and executive staff, unanimously. Just a piece of background. In case you didn't know, we've told you this before, in the judgment of the faculty majority and executive staff, of all the events of the last few weeks, how many has it been now? It seems like a year. Probably the single most decisive event, and for many of us, the single most surprising event, was the action which you students took on Monday morning, January 21. It was decisive, as I've had occasion to say to you before in an update meeting, because it certainly did help to do as a delegation of your students had said it should do for us faculty. You explained your action by saying to us just on the moment before we walked into our meeting, if what we have done liberates you from concern for us, the students, so that you now may be freed to make the kind of witness to the church and the world that you have to make, then it was worth it. Thank you for that. But it was decisive also for another reason. And that other reason has only recently begun to emerge in our consciousness. Prior to Good John's suspension, which wasn't all that much of a surprise, was it? It was just the question of how and when. What I suppose a good many of us anticipated was that when John would go, who had come and identified with us and with our confessional stand 4 years ago as our spokesman and our defender, so would also, in short order, it was just a matter of time, at least a third of the faculty go. And when we'd go, we would scatter to the four winds and would soon be dispersed. And I guess in our cynicism, in our unfaith, we had pretty well assumed that the waves would close in once more, and at least the students would stay there. Well, you surprised the socks off of us. What turned out to be our greatest blessing, namely your action, with all of the consensus and the solidarity with which you took it, you became overnight our burden. Our marvelous, happy burden. Look, kids, Mommy has suddenly brought you about 400 and 450 baby brothers and sisters. You are our happy burden. We have suddenly inherited a student body. And we would no more think of separating ourselves from you after that than we would separate ourselves from our own wives and children. Believe me. So we are now one community, and we've got to do something with one another. Well, in these latter days, the rhetoric of exile has gained new currency in our midst. I've been reminded these days, I've been haunted by the question that was addressed to Blessed Martin. And Dr. Luther said the questioner, what will you do and where will you go when the church has abandoned you? Antwort, out under the stars of God's free heaven. Elie Wiesel, who speaks for a people who should know something about exile, said, exile is home. Well, what I'd like to do, and it'll take only a moment, is to read to you, in behalf of the faculty majority and the executive staff, to you, the students, and to your wives, a statement which we just adopted this afternoon. It reads, a statement to the student body. The faculty majority affirms the following. Number one, its determination to stand with the student body in calling upon the church either to find the faculty guilty of false teaching or once more to exonerate it. Number two, its commitment to complete the winter quarter courses and to give academic credit to all enrolled in these classes. Number three, its commitment to provide classes and other services during the spring quarter, following as closely as possible the previously planned and announced curriculum. Number four, its intention to certify and place candidates on May 1 and vicars on March 22. Number five, its determination to develop ongoing theological education for graduate students, first-year men, vicars, and entering students in the fall of 1974. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bertram, and thank you, faculty. There are rumors going around, and this one's a real rumor. It is true that there will be no student meetings whatsoever tomorrow. We're having a Sabbath. The Moratorium Coordinating Committee had one man as its spokesman, and in a very real sense as its leader. We're going to ask Jerry Miller, the student body president and chairman of the Moratorium Coordinating Committee, to say a few words to all of us about where are we going? Where do we go from here?
Thank you. That was fantastic. I've been asked to say just a few words about where we go from here. I wish I could answer that. I wish that I could plot it all out. I wish that we could project it up here on the walls and you could trace it along with me. But unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be possible. The truth is that it's a lot easier to point to the past than it is to point to the future and to say where we're going. 2.5 weeks ago, we resolved to skip classes for a considerable amount of time. In 2.5 weeks from tonight, I can't tell you what we're going to be resolving. We've covered over 118,000 miles in Operation Outreach. I can't begin to tell you how many more miles we will have covered before this thing is over. We've met ourselves to death in small groups and large groups and medium-sized groups, and for that reason we have called a moratorium on the moratorium tomorrow. Those of you who are interested, we will be meeting at 8:30 on Friday morning in the Chapel Auditorium. But I'm not sure how many more meetings lie ahead. As Dean Dom said yesterday, at this point, we're a little bit like Abraham. He heard a call, and he started out, not knowing exactly where he was headed, not knowing exactly what he would do when he got there. But he believed that that call was from God. What I can tell you is that we're planning on a long trip. We're getting ready for the long haul. If we're wrong about that, if God has some surprises for us, if he shows us some shortcuts which we never dreamt of, we will rejoice. But if he asks for a little endurance, we will ask him for a little more strength, and we'll keep on going. Nice imagery. What does it all mean? It means that if the Board of Control can't answer our questions, we may not wait around forever for their answer. If the Board of Control can't prove that our professors are heretics, we might just assume that they're not. If in good conscience we cannot continue our education at 801 Dimon, then we may have to change our address. Believe me, none of us are anxious to do that. We're not jumping up and down with joy at that prospect. We are weeping, but we're willing. We're willing to say once more to the church as loudly and clearly as we possibly can that something needs to be done. And the strange thing is that while we're going along our way, we find that all kinds of other people are joining us. All kinds of other people are willing to put things on the line in order to say something along with us. And at this point, I would like to read that resolution which Jim McDaniels talked about just a few moments ago. Comes from the Black community, and it's entitled A New Dimension of Concern Within the Lutheran Crisis. Some of the Black constituency of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod have tried to maintain a low profile within the present controversy of the Church. However, recent developments of overt racist acts in the area of missions and ministry and education have literally pulled the Black community into the crisis with a response of outrage. We therefore pledge ourselves to Jesus in the spirit of liberation, as exemplified in our Black fathers and mothers and other oppressed people, to continue to fight the good fight of faith. And the Black people are not the only other people who are joining with us. All you have to do is look around you tonight, and you will see that there are others who share our concern. The size of the group is picking up not because we're all anxious to leave Missouri, but because we're all anxious to see a Missouri which is pleasing to God. God help us to that end, and the Lord be with you.